The following program is sponsored. The opinions and statements made by the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the views of WBOB or its parent company, the Chesapeake Portsmouth Broadcasting Corporation.
On the steps of the Supreme Court today, abortion rights activists grab back the megaphone.
My body, my choice!
Women should have the right to do with their bodies what they want to do with their bodies.
Hundreds of protesters were joined by Democrats looking for votes in 2020.
We will not go back!
Demonstrations organized in cities nationwide, triggered after a wave of restrictive abortion laws passed in multiple states.
Should a child, a life, inside a mother's womb be killed due to the actions of its parents?
Abortion care is safe and still legal in all 50 states.
But that message may not be getting through.
I've seen patients that are already scheduled for their procedures calling in, asking whether or not they're going to be able to access care.
Katie Caldwell is the coordinator at an abortion clinic in New Orleans, one of three in Louisiana.
You don't do a lot of interviews.
No, I don't.
Why?
Personal security reasons, but I think that now is kind of a tipping point. And so because I'm able to, I will visibly and vocally advocate for this.
There's a large group of people in this country who believe life starts at conception and the taking of that life is murder. Mm-hmm. Why isn't that the case?
That's a difficult question to answer. Everyone's entitled to their beliefs. They are not entitled to infringe upon other people's bodily autonomy.
At the Louisiana Capitol,
we believe the babies in the womb are worth having the same opportunity to live as all of you.
A state law banning abortions as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy is likely just days away from being passed. Stephanie Gosk, NBC News.
Black and orange stray cats sitting on a fence. By with my tail in the air. Stray cat strut, I'm a
cat.
I'm a feeling Casanova.
Hey, better not sign.
Get a shoe thrown at me from a mean old man. Get my dinner from a garbage can.
Time, the city has, as you know, we talked about this, a rat problem, and it's just not the rats that are in the Capitol and on K Street. It is real rats running around. You learn here to coexist with them, but the mayor of Washington and the city council, they have hired cats. Yes, they have hired cats. I'm going to bring Sammy up here the next time I come because we got them running around our condo here in Eastern Market, but they have hired what they call the Blue Collar Cats Program. This is from the nonprofit Humane Rescue Alliance. They launched this in January. It's a few months old. And Blue Collar Cats traps feral cats. They neuter them. They get vaccinated. And they release them back into high rat populations areas of Washington, D.C., in the streets and alleys where they have the highest reported rat infestation. So, and it's working. So the cats get a job to do. There's 50 of them so far that have been recruited here in D.C. But I'm going to bring Sammy up the next time I come because we've got some of them. What they do is they eat the holes right out of the garbage can. So they get a plastic garbage can like the city has here in D.C. The big rats, what they'll do is they will chew a hole in the bottom of it. Yes, they'll chew a hole in it. And then that's like their rat door for breakfast every day. And they go in and out of it. I mean, it's about you learn to coexist with them. But the next time I come up here next week, I'm absolutely taking Sammy. And I'm just going to put him out there by the garbage and he'll put a scent there, and that'll be the end of him because rats don't like cats. So, hey, we have a cat. We have feral cats running around in D.C. trying to get rid of the rats. But I don't know how you get rid of the rats on the Capitol and on K Street, right? We'll have to figure that out, and especially in the Judiciary Committee. John Frederick's Radio Network, Sheriff Clark, America Sheriff, coming up. And got a lot to talk about today. We're looking forward to him. We're not going to be talking about rats. We're going to talk about a lot of other things. Sheriff Clark, great to have you, sir.
John, a hearty good morning to you and your listeners. You know, the what I want to know is if the government shuts down, will those cats receive back pay?
That's right. Well, they certainly are well-fed. And in the areas where they released them, this is a real program in D.C., and it's been effective. So they capture these feral cats. They train them by giving them food in the cage and stuff, and then they release them in high rat population areas. And so this started in January. So what, we're 5 months in, and everybody in those areas are reporting a reduction in the rat population. So, but then what they have, they're having a problem of getting the feral cats back because they want to put it back in the cage and take them out somewhere else, but they can't do it because they're having too much fun eating all the rats. So it's like, you know, what are you going to do, right? But I'd rather have the feral cats running around than the rats. I think they should get released in the Capitol. What about you?
Yeah, but I think a different kind of cat. How about lions and tigers? Will unleash them into the Capitol to get rid of that rat infestation.
What do you think now? They've subpoenaed Hope Hicks. They subpoenaed Annie Donaldson, the Trump's lawyer. You know, we had Corey Lewandowski on last week, and he said that, he was Trump's campaign manager. He said so far he spent, get this, $500,000, $500,000 on lawyers defending himself against these subpoenas. And he's like, all I did was take a job managing a presidential campaign, you know, and so every penny that I was paid has gone to lawyers. And his view is that the Democrats just want to bankrupt everybody that worked for Trump. What do you think of that?
Yeah, exactly what they're doing. Now, they know this isn't going to lead to anything. They're still running around with this, dragging this dead horse around of the Mueller witch hunt. I think it's a shame that this is affecting American citizens who are engaged in the political process, like Corey, a friend of mine. That's First Amendment protected to be involved in the political process. And now the Democrats on Capitol Hill are trying to make this a crime, all in an attempt to undo the 2016 election. And it's over 2 years. We're probably closer to the next election than we are from the last one, and the Democrats want to keep this going. This is a election year ploy to keep the president occupied, keep the headlines going. While we need entitlement reform out of Congress, we need an infrastructure bill out of Congress, we need debt reduction out of Congress, we need immigration fixed out of Congress. I can go on and on and on with the real work that the United States Congress should be doing, and instead they're playing these political games, and it's coming at the expense of the American people, because in the long run, I think this is why China won't yield and come to an agreement on trade. They know that this president has political trouble back home. They'll just wait him out, if nothing else. I think North Korea is watching this. I think that's why Kim started up some missile testing again. I think Russia is watching this, and that's why they're engaged in some of the hijinks that they are. There was a Russian bomber jet intercepted off of Alaska the other day. I think this is all impacted by the fact that this president's under siege back here at home.
So you think there's a correlation between the Democrats' view of foreign policy and how they're trying to tie the president up with all these legal matters? You find a correlation there?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, this is the kind of thing that will have a it will be a residual effect of this sort of thing. The world watches this stuff. I think there are other countries too as well, and it lessens the for the countries that are on our side, it lessens the confidence that they have in relying on the United States. But again, you know, the Democrats, they don't care about that. They don't care about the damage it's doing to this republic. They only care about political power. They're doing everything in their their power to remove this president. They know they can't remove him. You know, I wish somebody in the Trump administration would, at the highest level you'd have to go, would call their bluff and say, go ahead and impeach him, because that would spell doom, I believe, for the Democrats going into 2020. The American people do not want this president impeached. At some point, though, I think the president needs to stare him down, not blink, and say, go ahead and do it, because they'll never convict him anyway in the Senate. They'll never get two-thirds of the United States Senate to convict him, which is part of the process, and that's the key part of the process. And also, I hope that the Republicans are taking copious notes, because this is how the Democrats play. This is how dirty they get. Mm-hmm. They'll do anything and everything to gain political power. And I just want the Republicans to look back at the Democrats and go, you know what? We're watching you. We're taking copious notes. Wait till your guy or woman is in the White House next time. You're going to get the same treatment.
It's unbelievable what the Democrats are doing, but I am with you on this, Sheriff Clark, 100%. And I said this in my narrative at 6 a.m. I'm in favor of the Democrats going forward with impeachment in the House. I think they should have the hearing, you know, stop talking about it and just do it. Because, look, they did this. The Republicans did this to Clinton in 98. And when it was all said and done and he got exonerated by the Senate, or I don't know if the word is exonerated, he didn't get impeached by the Senate. They couldn't get two-thirds, nowhere near that. I don't even think they got 50%. So when that was over, his approval rating went to 78%, and they won 8 seats in the House the next midterm election. So, you know, go ahead. You want to have the sideshow. You want to put it on TV every day. You want to show the American people what your agenda is, which is all this crackpot stuff. Go ahead. Do it. And let the chips fall where they may. And I think Pelosi is under a lot of pressure to do that right now. So I'm with you on that. I want to talk about, Sheriff Clark, an op-ed you had on Town Hall, if I may. And you titled it "The Black Community's Holocaust." Will you elaborate on that, Sheriff Clark?
Sure. Sure. Thanks for bringing that up. For your viewers, your listeners, they can go to Town Hall and read the entire column. But as you know, the state of Alabama passed and the governor signed an abortion bill that makes it one of the strictest in the nation. And so, of course, that caused the left to go bananas. You're seeing some other states, you know, Georgia's done much the same, where they're shortening the time period with which an abortion can be performed. And as I always do, before I put pen to paper or open my mouth or do my research, I went back and looked at some abortion statistics. And what I saw, it just floored me. 36% of all abortions are performed on black women. Black women only represent 14% of the population. The reason I mention that is because the Democrats are always coming up with this disparate impact argument when it comes to issues of race. I also saw that, in another research piece, since Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973, 19 million black babies have been murdered, have been slaughtered through abortion. Think about that. 19 million black babies have been murdered through abortion. And that's why I call it the Holocaust. If you look at the definition of what a Holocaust is, it's needless slaughter, reckless killing of people, and that's what abortion is.
I mean, when you call it a Holocaust and you look at the number of African-American babies that have been aborted since Roe v. Wade, what is the bigger message here? I mean, forget the Alabama law and the debate on that, but what is the bigger thing that's going on in your mind with this?
Well, if you look at who the founder of Planned Parenthood is, Margaret Sanger, she was a eugenist. She was a stone cold racist who called black people human weeds that were in need of extinction. And she tried to do it through abortion. So, you know, if you look at it that way, it's pretty plain to see. But this is having a negative impact, I believe, on the birth rate of black babies. You know, go back again. Listen, 19 million black babies have been murdered through abortion since 1973. I don't think that there's any other figure that comes near that in terms of death. Not famine, not natural disasters, not war. Nothing comes near 19 million people. I'm floored by that, John. I really am. And I did not know that until I went back and did some of the research. But these are some of the things that the lamestream media, the liberal media, are not going to talk about, are not going to put out there for people to see. People need the truth. And I think that's why trends and attitudes about abortion are shifting back in favor toward protecting the unborn over the last 10 years, because more information is getting out about how hideous this process is and what they're actually doing. And so I just want people, and that's why I wrote this, I want people to know the impact that this is having on a segment of this community that people don't know about. So, you know, one of the other things I looked up and I found is that the left likes to bring up, well, you know, what about cases of incest and rape? And I said, no. 1.5% of abortions performed in the United States are the result of rape and incest. And I'm not going to say that's no big deal, but 1.5%, that means 98.5% of all abortions do not involve rape and incest. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about some of these other things that I mentioned. Let's talk about late-term abortion. Let's talk about partial birth abortion. Let's talk about full-term abortion when babies are delivered, like your governor there in Virginia, Northam, was talking about. Well, we'll keep it comfortable, and then we'll decide a couple days or a couple weeks later whether to kill it. Those are the things that I want to talk about in terms of abortion, not the 1.5% cases of rape or incest.
So if you just take out the 1.5% of rape or incest, which, you know, a lot of us that are pro-life Catholic like me, I really believe that that woman should have that decision to be made, because the decision to get pregnant was certainly not hers. Or
sure.
In the matter of incest, it was just a bad thing. It's all bad. So I think they should have that right, and I believe in that. But if you take that number out, I mean, when you call it a Holocaust, I mean the number of African American babies aborted is staggering. Have you looked at that, what the percentage is of blacks in America, what the percentage of it is as it relates to, say, another race, Caucasian, Asian, Hispanic?
Yeah, and I don't have it broken down that deeply, but when it comes to abortion, I believe 24% of abortions are performed on Hispanic women, and I believe that the Caucasian or white women that have abortion performed is about 19%. So when you look at the numbers, you can see that black and brown women are having, you know, abortions performed on them more than any other demographic. And I think that with Planned Parenthood and the funding, and think about this, that's another thing, is our federal government, and this includes the GOP too, who like to run around calling themselves pro-life, there's funding, federal funding for abortion. So we have federal funding that's been involved in the killing of 19 million black babies. So when you look at all this stuff, though, and you add it all up, you know, I agree with what you said about, you know, that's an argument for rape or incest. I've never said that it shouldn't be, but I'm not going to let the Democrats try to make me feel bad about the Alabama abortion law because it doesn't allow for rape or incest. I agree with you. I think it should. But again, that's 1.5. So if you and I said to the Democrats and to the liberals and to the left, okay, I'll tell you what, if we put in the Alabama law, or if Alabama, I don't live there, if they put in there for rape or incest, would you approve of this law? And they would say no, because that has nothing to do with it. That's a gotcha question. That's a rabbit hole they try to drag you down to make you and I feel bad about the Alabama law, when in fact the Alabama law is going to prohibit late-term abortions, it's going to prohibit partial birth abortion, and it's going to prohibit post-birth abortion, and that's the important part of that law. So maybe Alabama goes back and cleans it up a little bit, but the rest of that law, I'm down with it, John.
You know, Sheriff Clark, if you looked at this a different way, it could almost be called genocide. If you looked at it, if you just turned it upside down and looked at the percentage and the number of African-American babies aborted in the U.S. since Roe v. Wade. And I have to look the percentage up, because I would think that it is a dramatically higher percentage than it is for any other race. And so it's almost like a limitation on the expansion of the black race. And it's mind-boggling to me how blacks would be in favor of abortions running amok into the third trimester, into, like Ralph Northam said, after the baby is born, you then make a decision. I mean, how does that jive? How does that reconcile itself?
Yeah, it doesn't. And it shows the lack of a soul, I think. It shows the lack of any sort of moral compass on the part of those American people. And I think it's a shame that it's come to this. And, it's, you know, New York State, by the way, just passed a law and signed into law by the governor that allows late-term abortion. So you see how the left keeps pushing the needle the other way. It first started out with Roe v. Wade, as you know, with cases of rape or incest, and it started with in the first trimester. Okay? Most people still didn't agree with that. I shouldn't say most. A lot of people still didn't agree with that. But then look at how far we've come since 1973 in Roe v. Wade. And I went back and read some of the majority opinion on Roe v. Wade, and it was decided, I think it was 7-2. So it was pretty, a pretty good amount of the justices agreed with it. I think they were wrong. Don't forget there were two dissents. I think that it is time for the United States Supreme Court to go back and visit this and not to overturn it. I don't think they're going to overturn it. But what I think needs to happen, and I put this in the column, return this back to the states. Let the states decide. This should be a states' rights issue, and if Alabama wants to do that, fine. If New York wants to say we're going to allow late term, I don't think that's okay. But if I'm going to say it should be a states' rights issue, well, in New York, the people in New York get to decide on that, not somebody like me living in Wisconsin. But I would push for stricter laws in my own state. One of the arguments, too, that I don't think we should get bogged down in, it's a rabbit hole, is the number of weeks that should be allowed to go by before a woman loses, and I don't want to call it a choice because it's not, but to have an abortion performed. You know, we're getting bogged down. Should it be 8 weeks? Should it be 12 weeks? Should it be 21 weeks? I'll tell you the definition I like, and it's mentioned in the Supreme Court decision, by the way. When a fetus is viable, now some states, I think it's Georgia, after a heartbeat's detected, they said no more abortion. I'm down with that. Viability, and I don't mean outside the womb. If there's a heartbeat detected, then you know what? No more abortion. So, but let each state decide that. Make it a states' rights rule, since the United States Supreme Court has said that babies in the womb have no constitutional rights. Well, if it's not a constitutional issue, then it's reserved for the states under the 10th Amendment.
I couldn't agree more. Really, though, and I appreciate you doing this column. I tweeted out, go to townhall.com. You can read Sheriff Clark's column. He calls it the Great African-American Holocaust. And it's a pretty deep piece, and I would encourage everybody reading it just to get an understanding of it. But we're out of time for this segment. I want to thank Sheriff David Clark for being with us. More information, go to americasheriff.com. That's americasheriff.com. He's also on the board of advisors at We Build the Wall, Inc. You can go to webuildthewall.org, webuildthewall.org. Sheriff, thanks for being with us. I always appreciate the time. And on a lighter note, your Cubs and my Astros, two best teams right now in the major leagues. I think they're going to square off in the fall classic. We're going.
John Redwood.
You know, if you really want to look at why is Biden surging, it's because there are Democrats out there that are like sane. And so they look at Biden and they say, okay, well, he's sleepy, creepy Joe. At least he's not nuts. And for him, he's not crazy.
Stay connected online and take him wherever you go. To get the free John Frederick Show app, follow on Twitter at JF Radio Show.
In the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. That should be on his campaign sticker. Joe Biden for president.
Radio, AM 600, 101.1 FM, WBOB.
With SRN News, I'm Gordon Griffin. President Donald Trump is at the Imperial Palace in Tokyo for his state call with Japan's new emperor. The president, the first world leader, to be meeting with the new emperor since Naruhito ascended to the throne in May. The president and First Lady Melania Trump are participating in a welcome ceremony to kick off the formal visit. It's all part of the president's four-day visit to Japan. Authorities say a tornado leveled a motel and tore through a mobile home park near Oklahoma City overnight, killing two people, injuring at least 29 others. A second twister later raked a Tulsa suburb, but no deaths were reported there. The first tornado touched down in El Reno late Saturday night. Mayor Matt White says it crossed an interstate and walloped the American Budget Value Inn before ripping through the Skyview Estates trailer park. Two people were killed at the mobile home park. This is SRN News.
Maybe you'd like to know what exactly Relief Factor is. It was created by doctors. It's a 100% drug-free supplement with four key ingredients that simply help your own body deal with the natural inflammatory response that it has. It's easy to swallow, four little capsules in each packet, like the packet that I carry with me at all times. Three packets a day for a week, then two packets a day for 2 weeks, and I have just described the three-week quick start. And you will know in 3 weeks, that's the beauty of it, whether it works. They don't drag you on. That costs just $19.95. There's a very good chance that a very serious percentage of my listeners suffer from some sort of muscular or joint pain. You should try this for $19.95. That's all you can lose. If it works, they'll send it to you automatically. If it doesn't work, tell them not to send any shipments. And it's as simple as that. It is all at ReliefFactor.com. I've been using it for years now. Relief Factor.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow. And like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat. I would flip-flop all night long. I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you can move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed. It's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry MyPillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to
get
lose.
Get a two-pack of MyPillow's premiums for $69.98. That's only $34.99 per pillow, which is the lowest price ever offered on radio or TV. This offer is only available at MyPillow.com or call 800-950-9024. Use promo code WBOB.
For the best night's sleep in the whole wide world, visit MyPillow.com.
Are you searching for a church where the music and the message are God-honoring? Do you want to hear expository preaching with verse-by-verse presentation of God's Word? If you have said yes to these questions, then you are invited to worship at First Conservative Baptist Church, located at 12021 Old St. Augustine Road, just 1 mile south of I-295. Dr. Gene A. Youngblood, pastor, founder, invites you to worship.
Great news, folks! The Lighthouse Retirement Hour is finally available everywhere you listen on this great radio station Saturday and Sundays, or grab the iTunes podcast, the Spotify podcast, iHeart podcast, and coming soon to every device where you can say Siri or Alexa. If you love the combination of timely investing news, great conservative politics, you're going to love this show no matter how you listen. Get all the links on my website, LighthouseRetirement.com.
Joining us now, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, senior senator, ranking member of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Senator, thank you for joining us today on the John Fredericksville Radio Network, sir.
John, thanks for having me. It's always fun. I'm glad you're still the Godzilla of truth.
Well, thank you, Senator. You know, I always respect and greatly appreciate your candor. We don't always agree on everything, but I really appreciate and respect your straightforwardness. And in the spirit of complete disclosure, I want to tell our listeners, I publicly endorsed your reelection campaign in 2014. I voted for you also, and I look forward to seeing you at the 2019 Democratic Party of Virginia Gala on June 15th. We'll be there live, and I'm sure you'll come on my show live, as you always do with your lovely wife. So we're looking forward to that. Senator, as the ranking member of Senate Intel, you have access to classified information most of your colleagues don't have, can't ever see. you spent months going on Sunday TV talk shows and doing other interviews, saying that you had information that led you to speculate there was evidence of collusion between the Russian Federation and President Trump. You said 100 times, I have more questions than answers. But after 2 years of investigations, Senator, $35 million, Special Counsel Robert Mueller found no evidence of collusion. Some people say, and I ask the question, are you obsessed with Russian collusion? And when are you going to just publicly acknowledge it? It didn't exist.
John, I'm obsessed about a foreign country using 21st century tools, attacking the United States and our democracy in 2016. I'm pretty obsessed also about the fact that the Mueller investigation, 37 indictments, 8 guilty pleas, still waiting on people what's going to happen with Roger Stone. I don't know about you, but I think the fact that there were over 140 contacts between Russians and folks affiliated with the Trump campaign, that the Trump campaign manager turned over campaign documents to a known Russian spy, that we still don't know in terms of the extent of Roger Stone's connections ties to WikiLeaks, which was acting as a Russian agent. Now, I will accept Mueller's conclusion that they didn't reach the level of conspiracy, since collusion, as we all know now, is not even a legal term. But what I'm focused on right now is how do we prevent this from happening again in the future? Because Christopher Wray, the FBI director, said just 2 weeks ago, they'll be back. So let me briefly do 3 things that I think we ought to do on a going-forward basis. Number one, if all those things that happened in 2016 didn't violate the law, I'll accept Mueller's conclusion. But I think what we ought to have, if a foreign government tries to intervene in the next presidential election, or whomever, let's face it, the Russians don't have a favorite in terms of party. Right. There ought to be an affirmative obligation to tell the FBI. So at least law enforcement is aware of an attempt to meddle. Number two, we ought to make sure we pass bipartisan, and my partner on this is very conservative Senator James Lankford, election security reform, so that if somebody does hack in, as it was more and more evidence is coming out in terms of specific states that I couldn't talk about in the past, that there's a paper trail after the fact, so even if the voting machine is hacked in, there's an ability to audit to make sure Americans have faith in our election system. And third, and we've talked about this on your show a number of times, I think there's got to be some rules of the road for the social media companies, because the ability of foreigners or others to manipulate, create fake personas, and candidly drive a lot of the news. News oftentimes that splits us as Americans because it's in a foreign country's best interest. I think we need to have rules of the road on that. I'll say what I've said to you before. If you look at what Russia did in 2016 in America, what they did in the Brexit vote, and what they did in the French presidential elections, add that all up, it's less than the cost of one new F-35 airplane. Russians and others are going to do this because it's cheap and effective, and I want to prevent it from happening in the future.
Right, but what does that have to do with Trump and collusion or conspiracy? I mean, I'm just looking for an acknowledgement that, I mean, you had a lot of people on your side telling us every day in the news, month after month after month, that he was a Russian asset, or like he was a Russian agent. I mean, we had to deal with this, Senator, for two years.
No, I didn't say it. What I said is, I think it's, and we still got some work to do, I think it is, was more than a little bit particular, or more than a little bit coincidence, that you had this much many outreaches from Russians, mm-hmm. that there was clearly offering of dirt, mm-hmm. that was clearly interest in receiving that. But I'm not here to relitigate 2016. I'm here to say, how do we make sure when we've been warned by the FBI that this doesn't happen again in the future? And John, doesn't it bother you a little bit? You know, I would never question your patriotism. You know, I think we all want to make sure we protect our country. But it does bother me, John, when Mr. Trump's Secretary of Homeland Security, Ms. Nielsen, wanted to have a cabinet meeting about protecting our elections in 2020. She was told not to have that because it might upset, I guess, the sensibilities of the president. That, to me, is not making our nation safer.
Well, look, I agree with you there's all the evidence is there. There's no question that with a little bit of money, I think you said the total cost of one F-16, the Russians have meddled in a bunch of elections, ours,
right.
United Kingdom's, France's, and there's got to be a way that we can prevent this in the future. But I really think that's a separate issue. But I agree with you on that. But as far as this president conspiring, I mean, that whole thing was ridiculous from the beginning. And a lot of us are bothered by what is potentially now the fake dossier given to the FISA judge. Was he or she aware, this secret judge, that a lot of this information came from Oppo Research, paid for by First Debbie Wasserman Schultz, or not, well, actually, first the Beacon.
I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, what I find is curious, and if there's going to be some investigation about the origins of the bias efforts, I can't obviously talk about that, but it's very curious that if you look at the Senate Intelligence Committee, which mm-hmm. has got very, very conservative members mm-hmm. on it, mm-hmm. they are not the ones who are saying, oh, let's go into the origins of all this, because they've seen the data, the underlying documents, the background, and I think if that all comes out, it will prove, frankly, if the FBI hadn't opened some of these investigations, they would have been derelict in their duty. Mm-hmm. But let's go ahead, and I understand the Attorney General's going to look into that. But it would be, I would again point out, you look at the Republican members on the Senate Intel Committee, they are not the ones making all of these noises, because they've seen the background.
Okay. I'll grant you that. But it sounds like that you're in favor of William Barr's and the Inspector General's investigation.
No, I don't think it is needed, but if it answers people's questions, and the Attorney General, I've not been happy with this Attorney General. He appears to be more interested in being the president's personal lawyer than the Attorney General. But if it will clear up your questions and others, this was still, at the end of the day, what the Russians want, or any foreign enterprise, is they want to see us in disarray. And again, they've done a pretty good job. If you look at what I'm working on, I'm trying to make sure this doesn't happen again in the future. I'm trying to make sure we're aware, alert, and aware, for example, of some of the challenges we now face with China, where I'm going out always with a Republican senator and trying, usually Marco Rubio, and briefing business leaders, academic leaders, and others about the ongoing challenges with China. I think, today we're going to be dealing with Iran. I do worry at times, and I say this recognizing, Virginia's is the home of our Navy, and we have some of the highest per capita military spending of any state in the country. And it's good for our economy, some of that defense spending. But I worry that in a nation like ours, where we're spending $716 billion on defense, that we may be spending too much on 20th century military hardware in a world, whether we see Russia, China, others, where much of the conflict in the 21st century will be in the cyber domain, will be in the misinformation, disinformation domain, will be in the realm of space. And my fear is, particularly vis-a-vis China, who spends about a third of what we spend on defense, but takes that $500 billion delta and invests in next-generation technology, that we're living through right now, kind of our generation's Sputnik moment, with China trying to move ahead on 5G and the Huawei equipment issue, the areas around artificial intelligence. This is one area, actually, John, where I agree with the president. We've got to recognize some of the national security threats that are being posed mm-hmm. By China in a variety of domains, and I think, candidly, we have been slow to rise to that alarm.
You're listening to the John Fredericks Radio Network. I'm your Godzilla of the Truth in America. We're with senior Democrat senator from Virginia. He's the ranking member of Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator Mark Warner. He's up for re-election third term 2020 here in Virginia. He's the favorite to win that. Democrats in the state have won 15 statewide races in a row. He would go for number 16, I believe. I'm somewhere close on that. Senator, you just mentioned basically the military-industrial complex. Now we've got the neocon saber rattling going on against Iran. These are the usual warmongers. You see them every day. They never change. Some things never change. Military industrial complex, NSA director John Bolton, the whole bunch of them now talking about, we had Tom Cotton the other day, one of the most unbelievable statements I've ever heard from a senator, saying, oh, all we have to do is drop two bombs on Iran, it's done. These are the same people who told me, Rumsfeld, that we could go into Iran and be out in 90 days. We have this new Swift army and the whole thing would be done. And Saddam Hussein would be gone and the world would be peaches and cream. We're getting the same thing now again with Iran. How do you stand on it? Where do we go from here?
Well, good question. First of all, I disagreed with the administration's decision to get out of the Iranian nuclear deal, even though that deal had flaws. I disagreed with the designation of the Iranian Iranian Revolutionary Guard terrorism designation because, not because they are bad guys and bad actors, but I was afraid that we might have this kind of reaction where the tension level has ramped up dramatically. I am very, and again, as a Gang of Eight member, I've been briefed, but I've been really been on the administration very hard to say, you know, you need to come up here and show other members of Congress in both parties at least the recent evidence of the uptick in Iranian activity, because that uptick is real for the very point you just made, John. God forbid if there was an incident that would require us to then react. I don't want half of America, or more than half of America, because candidly, there would be people in both the Democratic and Republican Party that were somehow thinking this was all being fabricated out of the White House. Because if we have a moment, the country needs to rally. I don't agree with Senator Cotton that Iran could be taken out with some short-term military action. I think it would be an extraordinarily challenging effort. We would be successful, but it would be a huge, huge challenge. And I think it is one of the reasons why the administration getting up here and briefing all the members of Congress so they can look at the evidence is extraordinarily important. I just wish it would have happened earlier.
Well, it needs to happen. As Senator, we were lied to in the second Iraq war about WMDs in Saddam Hussein's Iraq that never existed. They had never been found. They never existed. Now you go back and you look at a lot of statements that were made. A lot of people like me now are very suspect. I was opposed to that war at the outset. I was in the minority, but a lot of people now suspected this information coming out. And so, yeah, I think the senators have to get briefed, and so does Congress. And, you know, we're still operating under a AUMF from, what, 2000?
Yeah, I think, this is an area where Congress needs to do its job and has to be. Congress can't be a Monday morning quarterback on all this and then, you know, leave all this responsibility with whomever's the president and then blame that president after the fact. We have a constitutional responsibility. If we're going to go into war, it ought to be our responsibility, not left solely to the executive. But I would, and your very point about how we got into Iraq is one of the reasons why it is so, you know, any administration has to keep Congress informed. The one thing I do believe, and I see this each and every day, you know, the men and women who work in our intelligence community do a damn good job. They never get the kind of attention and credit that they deserve for keeping our nation safe. And one of the things that I've been happy about so far, because we've seen this president constantly critical of the intelligence community, is I think they have not politicized our nation's intelligence. I know I got a lot of grief, for example, for supporting Gina Haspel to be the CIA chief. But having that kind of steady hand and long-term professional in the job of the top at the CIA right now is critically important to make sure that Congress and others, when they brief, that they're getting briefed with the real intelligence and not politically driven intelligence.
Here's the good news. President Trump's instincts are to keep us out of these foreign entanglements. He said that he's been consistent in that since the day he came down the escalator. So I trust his instincts on it. That's the good news. Right now, though, yesterday, out of Yemen, Houthis firing missiles at KSA. Let me just ask you something. President Trump campaigned on getting out of supporting the Saudis in this disastrous war in Yemen, which has been going on. They've spent billions of dollars, people starving, children eating leaves off trees. It's a horrific situation. Why are we still there?
John, you're sounding like a... John, I agree with you on this. You know, I gave for years, because Saudis have been our allies in the area. It's a tough neighborhood, as we all know. But the Saudis' inability to even use our equipment in the way it was intended, with some precision, has been just awful. And I am part of what now is a pretty solid majority, at least in the Senate, of people that say we ought to be no longer financing this Saudi war, and we need the Saudis. The Saudis have the ability to bring a ceasefire to Yemen if they choose. And they have chosen not to. Clearly, the Houthis are being helped by Iran. Iran is not a good actor. They are a long-term threat to us. We have to be careful about that. But I have been, you know, this is a case where the president's much vaunted, you know, relationship with the Saudi leadership ought to be, you know, if he is the deal maker, he proposes to be, force the Saudis to end this crazy war in Yemen that you've already outlined with the human cost and what it also continues to do to destabilize the region. At the same time, I think the Saudis need to bring to an end this kind of internal, almost inter-family squabble with Qatar, which also further destabilizes the Gulf region. And particularly with this president and his family's relationship with the Saudis, I think he needs to demand and make some change in that, in how the Saudi government acts. We voted with a pretty solid majority, Democrats and Republicans, to cut off that military aid.
Senator, on this, we agree totally. You're absolutely right. The blockade against the state of Qatar has been a complete disaster. Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, has been proved now to be totally incompetent. Whether you look at the Khashoggi episode or anything he's put his hands on has been a disaster, including that ridiculous blockade against the state of Qatar, which has destabilized the Gulf region. We got the biggest base there. And so at some point, you just have to say, look, we're dealing with somebody that we just can't work with because he's incompetent. And I think we need to do that.
The Godzilla of truth, you need to get that message to some of your friends in the White House.
I'm trying, man.
I agree with you here, John. It's just, you know, I think for a long time, a lot of folks, you know, it is a dangerous neighborhood. Saudis have been, you know, our allies in the region, but their level of incompetence, particularly in waging this war, you know, this is not good. Obviously, for the region, and it's not good for long-term American interests.
I mean, when school buses are blowing up, and they're blowing up,
yes, sir,
markets with children running around, I mean, you just can't get more incompetent than that. And it never stops. There's no end in sight. Plus, they're losing the war. So the whole thing is absurd, and we keep going down the same path. All right, I've only got a couple more minutes. So I want to get to the USMCA. U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement replacing NAFTA, NAFTA, which, as you know, Senator, I'm a protectionist, so I hated NAFTA from day one. And at the time, I think I was one of three Republicans in opposition to it, me, Trump, and I think Pat Buchanan at the time. That was it. USMCA, are you going to be in favor of that or not?
You know, I'm still reviewing it, and I think I don't think it is that dramatically different than where we were with NAFTA. You and I probably, on this one, I was generally been more supportive around trade. Although one of the things I think we did horribly was, you know, the benefits of trade disproportionately went to, you know, wealthier communities, major metropolitan areas, and the communities that got hurt by trade, we did an awful job helping those communities. I think about Southside Virginia. And I think one of the missed opportunities we had when we did tax reform was to say, okay, companies, Apple, you want to repatriate all these offshore earnings? We'll give you a low rate, but you've got to reinvest some of those offshore earnings in communities that have been hit by trade to try to balance out some of the, you know, some of the challenges that come in a trading regime. We missed that opportunity. And on USMCA, what I've not seen yet is a major push by the administration yet to make the case. And I think most of us in the Senate have, frankly, if there's not that case made, this will never get out of the House in the first place. So, you know, will the Senate even take it up? But I'm going through it at this point. The Senate, you know, I've not had any outreach from the White House at all to try to, you know, try to convince me. And as you point out on this one, I've been more, you know, I've been more favorable towards trade than you and others. But they got to make the case, and the case has not been made yet.
All right. Hopefully they're going to do that. Final question. The president last week outlining a very comprehensive legislative immigration reform plan that mirrors what Canada and Australia have, ending chain migration if it were to pass, ending the lottery, the visa lottery, and going to a merit-based, skills-based system. For instance, if we have a need for pipe fitters and there are pipe fitters in Somalia or in Haiti, they go to the top of the list. And then also fixing the asylum laws, which a lot of people say are creating the crisis at the border. On the surface, any parts of that plan, Senator Warner, that you can back as an alternative to what we have now, which is really an open border situation?
I don't believe we have an open border, but we've got a completely broken system. And I do favor moving our system towards more merit-based. That's what Canada did. That's what Australia did. That's what the UK did. And it's one of the things where it's crazy right now. Well, you know, we train some of the world's best and brightest at our schools. Somebody gets out of ODU or out of Virginia Tech, they don't have to move back to, as you said, Somalia or Egypt or Brazil. They simply have to go to Canada. That will attract these high-skilled workers. What I was disappointed with the president was it feels like this was kind of a half-hearted effort. It doesn't satisfy Republican hardliners because it doesn't bring down the total number of immigrants. It doesn't satisfy any of the Democrats because he didn't even deal with the Dreamer circumstance. So, you know, some of the valued areas like moving towards merit, a more merit-based immigration solution, you know, I don't think people are going to get to that point. Now, I would go back and start as a starting point. What got 69, I think it was 69 votes 5 or 6 years ago, that was the comprehensive plan that increased border security, that moved towards merit-based system, but also dealt with issues like the Dreamers and some of the folks who are undocumented here. I think what I was disappointed in, you know, that the president didn't seem to want to go either direction. He didn't pick up all the Republicans, didn't start with any Democrats, and I'm not sure, again, this is an area where I think it is going to be more up to Congress to step up and put together a bipartisan plan, but part of that plan ought to be, as you said, moving more